This week's icon of Irish science is Waterford-born Ernest Walton, the man who split the atom and the only Irish person ever to win a Nobel Prize in science. I'm here in the Royal Irish Academy on Dublin's Dawson Street with Professor Vincent McBrearty, a colleague and biographer of Ernest Walton. Vincent, can you put Ernest Walton's contribution into some sort of context for the listeners?
Well, the most important thing for the listeners to know is that he was the only scientist to win a Nobel Prize, which in this era of scientific discovery in Ireland is quite remarkable, considering that there are, what, four literature and five peace prizes. He came along in the early decades of the 1900s. He was born into a country that was approaching independence. It was a country that was re-evaluating itself in many social aspects, and not least in science. And interestingly, a great antipathy towards science was growing up, for historical reasons mainly. And you had at the same time Yeats coming along talking about his cultural nationalism. And he was very influential, of course, in the first two, three decades. And as a result, there was a change in social values, and science was a major casualty in that rethink. So when Walton came along, he in fact had to deal with that era, and had, in hindsight, looking at his papers after his death, performed a massive job of work in trying to re-educate government and people in general as to the importance of science in many respects. For example, he, in 1957, 2 years before Lammas and Whitaker, had predicted the advent of the knowledge economy and had written to De Valera at the time saying we must put more emphasis on science, we must recognise that future industry will be science driven, we must recognise that if we depend on second hand industry coming into Ireland, we're a hostage to fortune. Very interestingly, had to make a choice between Queen's and Trinity for his post-secondary school education. And that was quite a choice for him. In the event, he opted for Trinity because he got an Armagh scholarship and he got various support from Trinity itself. He, of course, graduated with first-class honours in science and mathematics. And then he stayed back to do a master's in hydrodynamics under Professor Singh, who would belong to the famous Singh family, which included, of course, J. Millington Singh. Now, of course, his great ambition was to get to Cambridge. And Cambridge was the hottest research lab in the world at that stage. There were more Nobel Prize winners on the staff there than probably in many parts of the world combined. Rutherford, being the genius of a manager that he was, decided to get Cockcroft and Walton working together, with Walton's great practical skills and Cockcroft's ideas. And that started this marvellous partnership that led to the artificial splitting of lithium in 1932. Strictly, it's the splitting of the nucleus, not the splitting of the atom. But the headlines of the day was, it's the splitting of the atom.
So in terms of, in 1932, if you read the history books in Ireland, we're talking about the Eucharistic Congress. There was Cockcroft and Walton in Cambridge splitting the atom.
Rutherford was very anxious that the word of this did not leak out before they went into print. But one of the most marvellous pieces of documentation in his memoirs was his letter to his beloved Freda Wilson. He wrote to her in Waterford 3 days after the experiment. And one of the paragraphs goes roughly like this. Last Thursday was a red letter day. First, I got a letter from you. And secondly, Cockcroft and I did a marvellous experiment that in all probability will transform science. So his priorities were his letter from his beloved Frieda and then the experiment. And then he continues on in similar vein.
In terms of his discovery, what does it mean to us today, though?
Well, to understand what it means today, you have to understand what it meant then. The first thing it did was to validate the new wave mechanics theory. Secondly, it showed that you could make equipment to accelerate charged particles in a very controlled and systematic way. And the apparatus that they constructed then is still the basis of all the accelerators around the world, in CERN, in America and elsewhere. But thirdly, what is most fascinating is that it was the first experimental verification of Einstein's mass-energy relationship.
And it was Walton who first witnessed this, wasn't it?
Walton did the experiment on the, I think it was the 14th of April. He set up the equipment, he did the experiment, he saw the results, and the results were, in fact, the fragments of the nucleus striking a plate that fluoresced when they were struck. So he looked into this plate and saw flashes. And he said, my goodness, I think we have a result. So he immediately sent for Crockcroft, and he agreed. Then they sent for Rutherford, who was a huge man, and he had to get into this little small box-like observation place. They had to squeeze him in. And he looked and he says, my goodness, they are alpha particles. And if anyone knew what an alpha particle was, Rutherford did, because he first observed them and named them. He returned to Trinity in 1934 as a fellow, and he was there for the war years. And during the war years, he was approached by a number of people. First of all, there was Chadwick, who approached him, quote, to know would he join a group going to America on war work. So he says, well, what's the nature of the war work? Well, we cannot tell you that. Turned out to be the Manhattan Project. So, of course, Walton, being a fellow of Trinity and knowing that you cannot leave college without the Provost's permission as a fellow, went to Provost Alton, and Provost Alton says, under no circumstance we need you here for teaching. Now, also, later that year, C.P. Snow also invited him to do some war work for England, and he thought long and hard about it, and he cited his loyalty to the college and his loyalty to the Irish nation being paramount. In other words, Ireland needed his services more than England, if you like.
And he did his own war work whilst he was here.
Oh, he did. He worked, for example, on the development of power valves for the transmitter in Athlone and so on and so forth. And behind all of that, you can see the sacrifice he made in coming back to Ireland, where there was no money for research, there was no space, there were no people. And in 1934, he had the pick of the laboratories of the world to continue his research. But he gave that up in order to come back to Ireland to do his bit. And thankfully, he did, because he really championed the whole area of teaching of science in schools. And as I say, he had written to De Valera in 57 about the importance of science in industrial growth and so on and so forth. And you see, remember that when Walton did the experiment, he was a research student. Cockcroft was a fellow of, I think it was St. John's in Cambridge.
So he wouldn't have had his doctorate at this stage?
Oh, no. His doctorate was, as he said himself, based upon a whole string of experiments that didn't work. You know, and yet he said Rutherford was sufficiently benevolent to give him his PhD. But he was the junior partner. But yet, if you look at Hardcup and Allibone, who were the biographers of Cockcroft, they recognised that Cockcroft was really not an experimentalist. He was slipshod and he was careless. And the real genius in building the equipment was in Walton's hands. During the subsequent years, Rutherford himself was approached to know would he accept a Nobel Prize in physics, because the first one he got was in chemistry. And he said, no, give it to some of my junior people. And the history goes, or I suppose apocryphal history goes, that someone suggested Cockcroft. And Rutherford said, under no circumstances would it be Cockcroft without Walton. But one interesting factor, too, is why wasn't he elected Fellow of the Royal Society? You know, he had done one of the great experiments of the century, in fact. And there are various reasons for that, none of which can be proved or can be validated. But in any event, he was in good company because Hamilton wasn't a fellow of the Royal Society either. So he was in very good company.
Vincent, and finally, where would you put him in the hierarchy of Irish scientists?
It's very hard to talk about a hierarchy of scientists because you have to look at that hierarchy in the times in which the scientists lived. If you look at Hamilton, for example, in his times, brilliant mind at work, but in a cultural ethos that was sensitive to science, that was sensitive to the polymath dimension of knowledge, where science and poetry sat comfortably together, and so on and so forth. If you look at Walton and the very difficult circumstances in which he found himself, and when you think of the collective effort that he brought to bear, not only initially in his science research, but in establishing the culture and the thinking and the framework where other younger scientists coming up could thrive, he was unparalleled in my book. And his legacy is more an unspoken legacy and an undocumented legacy than would be the case for many other great scientists that I could think of.
Professor Vincent McBrearty, thank you.
You're welcome.
From the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin, let's go to Galway, to the National University of Ireland, to speak to Ernest Walton's son, Professor Philip Walton. Philip, can you tell us what influenced Ernest Walton to go into science in the first place?
Well, he was always very practical. He absolutely loved doing things with his hands. And at the school he was at, which is the Methodist College Belfast, they had workshops. And he also had, he reckons, his science and maths teachers were excellent. So I think they just, you know, excited him about it, really.
And this was the inspiration for him to
go into
science?
Yes, because there was no history in the family prior to that, you know. He was always very practical. He absolutely loved doing things with his hands, and he built a Van de Graaff accelerator. It charred. You may have seen a little demonstration they often have for kids at scientific shows, where you charge a person up and their hair stands.
Oh, yes,
have you
yes,
seen that?
Yes.
Well, it's a bigger version of that.
Oh, okay.
And I can remember as a young child, you know, on a Saturday morning, he'd be looking after me, say, as an 7 or 8 year old, and he'd go into the department, and for fun he'd show me the big sparks he could make. I can distinctly remember that. Got this Van de Graaff going, huge sparks would jump about a metre. It sounds terribly dangerous, but when you charge a person up, the currents involved are tiny.
And in his own family, was there much talk about physics and science around the dinner table?
No, very little. My mother was more interested in the classics. They met each other at school, by the way, you know. And so she didn't know anything about physics, really. And even though three of the four of us followed into physics, there was no pressure whatsoever. And actually rather little conversation about it.
Can you tell us about what the impact on him and on the family of him winning the Nobel Prize?
When he won it, which was 1951... there was three of us at boarding school, at his old school, Methody, in Belfast. And I was just 11, very young, just to go to boarding school. But anyway, that's... we didn't get many phone calls then. It was mostly letter writing once a week, which was a bit of a chore, but at home. And anyway, the phone did ring occasionally if there was something special. And I took the call from my mother, and she said, "Your father has a great honour. He'd been awarded a Nobel Prize." What's that, you know? At that age, you wouldn't have the first notion as to what it was about. But, of course, the next day in the school assembly, of course, it was announced, it was a famous, "This is an old boy." And the school was given a half day off school. So at this stage, it started to sink in that I was sort of a bit of a hero, nearly. My dad got you a half day off school, sort of thing. And there's a story about a little boy goes home to his mother, and his mother says, "What are you doing home again from that school? You know, they're always giving you half days off. Who is it, or what is it this time?" And he said, "I'm not sure." He says, "Somebody split something." So, but it did have an impact. He was always a pretty unassuming, shy sort of person, so to be suddenly put in the limelight, I think he quite enjoyed it at the time, actually. The financial aspect actually is quite significant too, because, I mean, struggling to send three of us away to boarding school and not a great university salary at the time. So the money meant quite a lot.
What was the prize at the time?
It was about £15,000.
Oh, that's a lot of money in those days.
1951 yeah. It was, you yeah. know. So he had one car at the time, which he didn't use very much. He cycled in and out of Trinity from Rathmines. But he started using his car more, and actually I bought a car for my mother then too, so it did make quite a difference. Yeah.
And did it come as a big surprise to him? Like, he the work he had done was in 1932, and here he was, you know, in 1951.
I think it probably was. There's another story which sort of illustrates his sort of modesty. The news got to him prior to announcement, just because he was told there would be press people coming to him, you know, they wanted to get the photographs ahead of the announcement and the things like that, so he knew something was in the air. And a press photographer had been there, and in those days they used the old magnesium-filled flash bulbs, you know, and there was some of them sitting on the hall table, the used flash bulbs, you see. Anyway, his close friend, who was Professor Cocker, who's still alive, professor of chemistry, was visiting him, just dropped in that night, and as he was leaving, he said, "Oh, by the way, have you taken up photography?" And he hadn't told him.
He's
probably his best friend, you know, that something was in the offing.
Sure. He was invited to go to the United States to work in the Manhattan Project. Did he ever regret not taking up that?
No, but you'd have to cast yourself back to those days, you know, and the evil of Hitler and whatnot, and the worry that he was going to have the bomb. I mean, in retrospect, he was not completely anti. He wasn't a complete pacifist in that sense. He would have gone along with it possibly, but he couldn't make up his mind. So he went to the provost, and the physics department then was very small. There was only about three or four staff, and already one of them had gone to Britain to work on a war effort. And the provost said, no, there's no way I could spare another person out of that department. So in a sense, the decision was made for him. He's kind of glad in retrospect, but he wouldn't have been totally anti the effort at the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did he talk much about his time working in the Cavendish and working with Cockcroft?
He loved to talk, later in life especially. I used to go and visit him in a nursing home and whatnot. And if you're ever stuck for something to say, just get started on Cambridge, and off he'd go.
Really?
You know? And he had an excellent lecture full of anecdotes about Rutherford and the various people there. Such as, just to illustrate, even when he got there to the mecca of physics at the time, they were hamstrung for money and facilities. And his story he used to tell was about, I think it was Lord Rutherford, but it might be his predecessor, J.J. Thompson, who was head of department, and had an eminent visitor in his office, and there was a knock on the door, and it was the chief technician carrying a bucket. And Rutherford said, "What is it this time? What's the problem?" "Oh, it's the bucket, sir," he said. "Well, what's the bucket? It's got a hole in it." "So, Rutherford, could you not mend it?" "It's been mended twice already, sir, you know, looking for permission to buy a new bucket."
Yeah.
So screws and nails and pieces of wood were all recycled. You had to go rummage in rusty screws and things, you know, and do a lot of it yourself.
This would be the most prestigious research institute, definitely in these islands, not in the world at the time. He was quite driven and persistent, though, you know, coming over from Trinity to getting into the Cavendish. He was quite driven man.
He was, because he, if I got the story quite right now, he applied to Rutherford to go there. And he got a rather negative letter back. And it more or less said he's absolutely stuck for space and he just couldn't. My father showed Professor Jackie Poole, senior member, who was there in my time too, in the physics department, the letter. And he had worked... he was a good friend with Professor Jolie, the geologist in Trinity. And the pair of them actually knew Rutherford. They had worked together on halos in rocks created by alpha particles from natural radioactivity. So there was some connection there. And they wrote on behalf of my father to Rutherford. And he just squeaked in the last day, sort of just got there, you know.
Professor Philip Walton, thank you. We've now moved to the Schrodinger Theatre in Trinity College with Dr. Eric Finch, who was the last person to be appointed to the physics department by Ernest Walton. Eric, what is the significance of the room we're in here?
Well, this theatre is the old physics laboratory theatre, which was built 100 years ago, and it was a theatre that E.T.S. Walton would have had his undergraduate lectures in, and it's also the theatre that he himself lectured in for many, many years when he came back from Cambridge, and he would have lectured here for 40 years, giving his lectures to large crowds of undergraduates with demonstration lectures, demonstrations in front of very appreciative audiences.
What sort of teacher was he?
He was a meticulous teacher. He was excellent. Generations of students remember him for the clarity of his presentations. In particular, as I said a moment ago, he would illustrate his lectures with demonstrations of simple physical principles in mechanics, in light, in heat, and sound, which students have remembered and speak still to us with pleasure. People in their old who are now in the older generation, engineers and medics, remember E.T.S. Walton giving these lectures. And he was, in a sense, a model for us, us to give our lectures and the way that we gave our lectures. And I've tried, and my colleagues have tried, to continue this tradition, particularly of demonstration lectures, which we give in this theatre and elsewhere, to particularly our large first-year classes. But E.T.S. Walton really was a pioneer in this.
Post-war, he was giving up to 17 hours of lectures a week. When you think of a Nobel laureate today giving 17 hours of lectures a week, is that true?
He had a very large lecture load. Trinity was extremely impoverished at the time, and he had no option but to give large numbers of lectures. But he wanted to come back to Dublin. He wanted to come back to his old University of Trinity. He didn't want to go after his work at Cambridge in the 30s. He didn't want to go elsewhere. He wanted to come back here despite the heavy administrative and teaching load that was involved.
Tell us about the Ernest Walton that you knew.
He was a true gentleman, a meticulous scientist, very careful, but very quiet, very modest, never trumpeted the fact that he was a Nobel Prize winner. I can remember, for example, when shortly after I arrived, He had great skill in fabricating equipment in workshops. He had a great manual dexterity, and he was still making equipment for undergraduates to use as part of their laboratory work and examinations. And he had great workshop skills as well. But he was very quiet, and he would sit quietly in the corner of the room, and visitors would never realize that here was one of the great names of science until they were introduced to him. That was the nature of the man.
Now, science and religion are usually seen as being in conflict with each other, but Walton had a very strong religious faith.
Very much so, and I don't think he saw any conflict between science and religion. The Methodist faith meant a great deal to him, and he was a pillar indeed of the Methodist Church.
He was 27 when he and Cockcroft split the atom. Are physicists like mathematicians in that they do their best work before the age of 40?
Difficult to say. Not necessarily. Schrödinger only just did his best work before 40. I think he was 38. We always say that mathematicians tend to do their best work very early. Physicists maybe a little later. Cockcroft was older. He was 7 years older than E.T.S. Walton. But certainly Walton did his world-renowned work, as you say, when he was young.
In the hierarchy of scientific discoveries, where would you put his splitting of the atom?
Oh, very high, because of the number of important principles that it established. One, this principle that it established, was the validity of the theory that Schrödinger had just developed of wave mechanics. And indeed, it was a result of the appreciation that Cockcroft and Walton had of wave mechanics that the experiment succeeded, whereas other people who didn't have this appreciation weren't able to do the experiment. Another crucial piece of work that this experiment succeeded in was to demonstrate experimentally for the first time Einstein's mass-energy equivalence, E equals mc squared. And indeed, Einstein himself came and visited Cockcroft and Walton only a few days after their atom-splitting work and expressed astonishment and admiration, I think are the words, at what they had done. Of course, they also were the first people to use an accelerator to accelerate particles as part of their research. It was groundbreaking work which caused the absolute sensation at the time. Walton was always at pains to make clear that his work did not directly lead to nuclear power generation or nuclear weapons, because power generation and weapons relies on two crucial things, neither of which Cockcroft and Walton developed. They relied on the splitting of very heavy elements like uranium, and they relied on the existence of neutrons in to propagate the chain reaction. Neither of this Walton and Cockcroft did. And neither did Walton and Cockcroft produce a net gain of energy in their work. In each individual reaction, there was a release of energy given by E equals mc squared. But overall in the experiment, most of the energy which was being put in by the particles being accelerated was just frittered away as heat. Only 1 in 1,000,000,000 of the incoming particles actually initiated a reaction. So in one sense, they were leading the way to nuclear power, but there were crucial other steps which had to wait for several years.
If we say Hamilton was the greatest Irish scientist of the 19th century, would you say that Walton was the greatest Irish scientist of the 20th century?
Oh, well, I suppose naturally I would, because he's a physicist and I am a physicist as well. But I certainly would feel that he is one of the greatest, if not the greatest Irish scientist. He's certainly the only Irish scientist ever to win the Nobel Prize.
Dr. Eric Finch, thank you very much.